You know, John tells us that Jesus did a number of things that aren't written down in his gospel, but he wrote these down so that we would believe that Jesus is the Christ, and in believing we would have life in his name. And he said that if you were to write everything down that Jesus did, he supposed that the world could not contain the books that would be written. And so as we come to chapter 6, we're kind of taking a little bit of a jump in time. In chapter 5, we were there by the pool of Bethesda, and there was the lame man that Jesus healed. And then there was the confrontation with the religious leaders because Jesus had healed on the Sabbath day. But now as we come to chapter 6, we find that we're up at the Sea of Galilee. And so a number of things have taken place between chapters 5 and 6. But let's go ahead and just jump into it. In chapter 6, verse 1, it says, "After these things, Jesus went over the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias. Then a great multitude followed him, because they saw his signs, which he performed on those who were diseased." So Jesus has left Judea, where Jerusalem is, and he had gone back up to the north into the area of the Galilee, and here he's heading across the sea, really to get away with his disciples. Now, when we put the other gospel accounts together, we see some of the things that took place between chapters 5 and 6 of the Gospel of John, like the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapters 5 through 7, the kingdom parables where he teaches on the sower and the seed. We find that Herod Antipas has had John the Baptist put to death. And we also see that Jesus has sent his disciples out on a preaching mission. When we look at Mark's gospel, it tells us that the 12 had just returned from ministering for the Lord, and Jesus was calling them aside to a deserted place, kind of to debrief with them, if you will. But as they get in the boat to go across the sea, the multitude sees which way they're going, and so they start running around the shoreline to be able to catch up with them when they get there. And yet we find Jesus not irritated by the people, but rather having compassion on the people because he saw them as sheep that didn't have a shepherd. And so our good shepherd is going to make them lie down in green pastures and feed them both spiritually as well as physically. Now, it says that he went over the Sea of Galilee. It's also referred to as the Sea of Tiberias. As you can see, Tiberias, it's one of the main cities that were on the western coast of the Sea of Galilee, built by Herod Antipas in the name of Tiberius Caesar. The Sea of Galilee also is referred to Chinneroth in the Old Testament, in the book of Joshua. And the Hebrew word for Chinneroth, the Sea of Chinneroth, means harp. And it might be because of its harp-like shape. It's also referred to as Lake Gennesaret in the New Testament, and Gennesaret is the in Greek means harp as well, and so maybe that's the idea with that. So it's got a number of names, and Jesus has gone over it with his disciples to get away. And we pick it back up in verse 3, and it says, "And Jesus went up on the mountain, and there he sat with his disciples. Now the Passover, a feast of the Jews, was near. Then Jesus lifted up his eyes, and seeing a great multitude coming toward him, he said to Philip, 'Where shall we buy bread that these may eat?' But this he said to test him, for he himself knew what he would do." Now, maybe he brought this up to Philip because Philip was, we know from John chapter 1, he was from Bethsaida, and this is the area that they're at, is around Bethsaida. They're up in the northeast of the Sea of Galilee. But we see that he did this to test him. Now, God does test our faith. He doesn't tempt us to sin, but he does test our faith. And he does that to make us strong. He does it so we can see where we're at. It's not so much that he can see where we're at, because he knows where we're at. But when our faith is tested, it shows us where we are. In James chapter 1, it tells us to count it all joy when we encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. And it goes on to say, "Let patience have its perfect work, that you might be perfect and complete, lacking nothing." So the trials, the testings, they do something for us, don't they? I mean, it puts us in a position. We kind of think we know how we would respond to something until we're actually put in a particular position, and then we see how we would respond to something. And so when our faith is put to the test, it produces something within us, and the something we see right here is patience. And I think when we go through difficult times, especially when there are times where we can't really handle it on our own, it teaches us how to be dependent upon the Lord, how to cry out to him and go, God, I can't make it through this without you. And so when we go through a trial again the next time, still difficult, but we can go, God, I remember you were there for me last time, and I'm going to wait upon you for the answer this time. So it produces within us something to help us grow, to make us strong. Peter, when he was talking about trials in 1 Peter chapter 1, he said, those trials come that the genuineness of your faith, being much more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to praise, honor, and glory at the revelation of Jesus Christ. That the genuineness of our faith, again, we kind of think we know where we are, but it's when we go into the difficult trials that we find out where we are. That we might, again, grow. And I look at this passage and I think about how gold, when you put it in the fire burns out those impurities. And so when we go through those fiery trials, oftentimes what happens is the self-confidence, the pride, starts getting burned away, where we recognize we can't do it on our own, that we need him. And so here, Jesus is putting Philip to the test. Jesus knows what he's going to do. And yet Philip, notice his response as we look at verse 7. Philip answered him, 200 denarii worth of bread is not sufficient for them, that every one of them may have a little. One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, there is a lad here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 small fish, but what are they among so many? Now, Philip assesses the situation and he recognizes there's too many people here. And it would take 200 denarii just so people could get a little. And a denarii was the pay for a laboring man for a day's wage. So 200 days' wages. So over 6 months worth of wages wouldn't buy enough for people to have a little. But you got to love Andrew because he comes up, we got this little kid's lunch right here, you know. But it's not a lot. But, you know, how many of you know Jesus doesn't need a lot? He just needs what we have to offer him to work with. And so we look in verse 10, then Jesus said, make the people sit down. Now there was much grass in the place, so the men sat down in number, about 5,000. How many of you know what's coming right now? This is the feeding of the 5,000, right? Where Jesus is going to miraculously feed them. And one of the other gospels tells us that there were 5,000 men, not counting the women and children. So how many people could be there? I mean, 10,000, 15,000 that are there? And I like the little details that just seem to jump out. He has them go and sit down, and the other gospels show us that they're in groups of 50s and groups of hundreds. It says here that there was a lot of grass in the area. In Mark's gospel, it says the grass was green. Okay, and you're just like, oh, okay, you know, little details. But then I think about Psalm 23 again. He makes me to lie down in green pastures. And isn't this the good shepherd? They're taking care of the sheep and feeding the sheep. It's kind of neat to look at that like that, isn't it? So he said, make the people sit down. Now there was much grass in the place. So the men sat down in number, about 5,000. And Jesus took the loaves. And when he had given thanks, he distributed them to the disciples and the disciples to those sitting down. And likewise of the fish, as much as they wanted. So when they were filled, he said to his disciples, gather up the fragments that remain so that nothing is lost. And so we see here Jesus taking this little boy's lunch and making more than enough to take care of the multitude that's there. It says he distributed them, the bread and the fish. I want to look at Mark's gospel for just a moment. In Mark chapter 6, verse 41, it says, and when he had taken the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, he looked up to heaven, blessed, and broke the loaves and gave them to his disciples to set before them. And the 2 fish he divided among them all. So I want to focus in on those 2 verbs, broke the loaves and gave them to his disciples. I wanted to read this to you out of Kenneth Weiss' word studies. He, referring to Marvin Vincent's word studies, says, Vincent has a precious note The verbs, the ones we're looking at here, broke and gave, are in different tenses. The former in the aorist, the latter in the imperfect. The aorist implies the instantaneous. So he just broke the loaves instantly. The imperfect, the continuous act. He continued to break the loaves, continued to break them. So the Greek has it, he broke and kept on giving. And that's how the New American Standard translates Mark 6:41. And he kept giving them to his disciples. The point being here is they just have a little bit, but the little bit in the hands of Jesus was more than enough, so that everybody could get as much as they wanted until they were filled. And I see that application so clearly for us. All of us have been given, I mean, we've been given this time in history, haven't we? We've been given these individual lives that are a gift from the Lord, and he's given us resources. He's given us talents, giftings. He's given us opportunities. And we might look at ourselves and go, well, I really don't have much to offer anybody. You know, what do I have that I can, you know, the little we have, and this is the key, the little we have in the hands of Jesus is more than sufficient. Can you see that? And that's the key, though, is taking what we have and offering it over to the Lord and giving it really back to him, because he's the one who's given it to us. When we give it back to him, he can do exceedingly abundantly above all that we could ask or imagine when we give it into his hands. Do you believe that? It's true. It's true. And so that practice of just, Lord, here's my life. Take it and use it for your glory. Now, the disciples here, and this is the neat thing about it, they have the joy of being able to take this food to these 5,000, 10,000, 15,000 people. And you can imagine the people. Mark's gospel tells us that they had been there most of the day, and Jesus had been teaching them. And so they're weary, they're hungry, and imagine the disciples. They get to go, hey, here's some fish, and here's some bread. And they're like, oh, thanks. So they get the joy of being the conduit. Same thing is true, I think. When we take the little we have and we put it in Jesus' hands and he uses that, we get the joy of being used by him and meeting the need. It's cool, isn't it? So again, Jesus in verse 12 wanted them to gather up the fragments that remain so that nothing is lost. Therefore, they gathered them up and filled 12 baskets with the fragments of the 5 barley loaves, which were left over by those who had eaten. Now, somebody tell me how you can fill 12 baskets when you only had 5 loaves to start with. It's Jesus, right? Then those men, verse 14, when they had seen the sign that Jesus did, said, "This is truly the prophet who is to come into the world." Now, we find this theme running throughout the gospel, that of the prophet, an anticipation of this coming prophet. Do you remember when John the Baptist, he was beginning his ministry and the religious leaders sent messengers and John said, "I'm not the Christ." "Are you Elijah then?" "No." "Are you the prophet?" Remember, so there's this prophet that's being referred to, and it's taken from Deuteronomy 18, where Moses told the people, "The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from your midst, from your brethren, him you shall hear." And so they were anticipating this prophet that Moses talked that would come, that would be like another Moses. And it's kind of interesting to think about what God did through Moses when Moses brought the children of Israel out of Egypt and they started complaining, "We don't have any food to eat." What did God do? He rained down manna from heaven to feed the multitudes. Isn't it kind of a neat parallel here as you see that? But they're anticipating the coming of this one that the Bible had spoken of, the prophet, the Messiah, the Savior of the world. And when I read that, I thought about these guys were in anticipation, and we're in anticipation too, aren't we? I mean, who are we looking for? We're looking for the return of Jesus, aren't we? And excited about that. We're looking at, should he not come before my life comes to its end? I'm looking forward to leaving this place and going to be with him. Should he come in my lifetime? I'm looking forward to him coming and snatching us all off of the earth. And on top of that, I'm really looking forward to his second coming, where this world will finally see a world in righteousness that's ruled the right way. And I think the more we fall from the morals of what the Bible has to say, the more I just long for him to come and rule and reign in righteousness, and that this world might might finally see what God initially intended before we messed it all up. You know, aren't you looking forward to that day? And so that anticipation, really, I guess you might say that we share. Some additional thoughts on the feeding of the 5,000. It's the only miracle that's recorded in all four of the Gospels. I know the resurrection is recorded in all four of them, but these type of miracles that he was doing during his ministry, the only one that's recorded, it shows that it was significant to be, I think, recorded in all of them. This miracle also witnessed to Jesus' identity, didn't it? I mean, the people said, this is the prophet who's to come into the world. And remember at the end of chapter 5, Jesus spoke of this fourfold witness. There would be the testimony of John the Baptist and of his father and of the scriptures and of his works, of his miracles. So this testified to that. It also jumped out to me that Jesus cares about the physical needs of man as well as his spiritual needs. And I always have felt, and I really still feel, that the most important need is spiritual, that a person needs to know the Lord, because, I mean, eternity is based on that. But the reality is they have physical needs as well. And as someone has aptly put it, they're not going to care how much you know until they know how much you care. And there are people who are hungry. There are people who are in need of companionship and in need of a number of things that, let's face it, we can offer to them to come alongside and help them out. And when I look at some of the patterns of the missionaries, that's oftentimes what they do. They go into an area and they meet the humanitarian need first to open up that door to give them, to feed them spiritually, if you will. And so let's move on from here and let's see the response of the crowd. They're first of all going, this is truly the prophet. And then verse 15, therefore, when Jesus perceived that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, he departed again to the mountain by himself alone. Now, when evening came, his disciples went down to the sea, got into the boat, and went over the sea toward Capernaum. And it was already dark, and Jesus had not come to them. Then the sea arose because a great wind was blowing. And so Jesus knows that these folks want to come and they want to make him king. And it's not time for him to be king. There's something much more important that has to take place. And we look at the other gospels and we find out that he actually took his disciples and he sent them away. And I don't know if he did that so that his disciples didn't go, hey, this is a good idea. I think you should be king. I'll sit on your right. You can sit on his left, you know, and let's get the show going here. So he sends them away. And again, the other gospels tell us that he goes up to the mountain and he's up there alone. And he's praying. And some commentators have pointed out, it's true. The Bible tells us that Jesus was tempted in all points as we are, yet without sin. And some point out that maybe this was a temptation to have the crown, to become the king, without the cross. But if there's no cross, there's no salvation. And so Jesus is up on the mountain and he's praying, and the disciples are heading across the lake, and it's nighttime now, and we read that there was a great wind that was blowing. This is Tenney quoted in Guzak. It speaks of the Sea of Galilee. The Sea of Galilee was 600 feet, or is 600 feet below sea level, in a cup-like depression among the hills. And when the sun sets, the air cools, and as the cooler air from the west rushes down over the hillside, the resultant wind churns the lake. And since the disciples were rowing toward Capernaum, they were heading into the wind. Consequently, they made little progress. And so they're out there in the dark of night, storms brewing, they're fighting against the wind, and they're just not making a whole lot of progress. Mark 6:48, I wanted to bring this out. It says, then he, Jesus, saw them straining at rowing, for the wind was against them. I look at that and I just picture him up on the mountain. He's praying. He sees the disciples down there. He sees what they're going through. And in all seriousness, it makes me think of his eye is on the sparrow. I know he's watching me and I know he sees what I'm going through. Verse 19. So when they had rowed about 3 or 4 miles, they saw Jesus walking on the sea and drawing near the boat, and they were afraid. But he said to them, it is I, do not be afraid. Then they willingly received him into the boat, and immediately the boat was at the land where they were going. So they're out there on the sea, and they're fighting against the wind. We're going to find out that it's between 3 and 6 in the morning at this point. So they've been out there all night, and then all of a sudden, Jesus is walking on the water. And Matthew's gospel, as we're going to see, they think he's a ghost. And so they're afraid. And Jesus is like, take courage. It's okay. It's me. And so they welcome him into the boat, and everything is okay. I just got to bring this out to you for the rest of Mark 6:48. It says, it was about the fourth watch of the night. He came to them walking on the sea and would have passed them by. Now, I see a comedic kind of thing in that right there. You know, they've been out on the sea all night. There's a storm, so it's difficult, even for seasoned fishermen. Then they see Jesus, and they think he's a ghost. And then this tells us that he's just going to walk by. You know, it's like, sup, guys, I'll see you over in Capernaum, you know. I don't know. I could be reading it wrong, but that's what I see. Let's turn over to Matthew's gospel in Matthew chapter 14, because there's one major detail that Matthew gives us. As I mentioned, Matthew 14, as I mentioned, the feeding of the 5,000 is mentioned in all four gospels. Jesus walking on the water is mentioned in 3 of the gospels. But Matthew pulls out a really important big detail here. Matthew chapter 14. And let's take it up from verse 22. Immediately, Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side while he sent the multitudes away. Verse 23 of Matthew 14. And when he had sent the multitudes away, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray. Now, when evening came, he was alone there. But the boat was now in the middle of the sea, tossed by the waves, for the wind was contrary. Now, in the fourth watch of the night, Jesus went to them walking on the sea. And when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were troubled, saying, "It is a ghost," and they cried out for fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, "Be of good cheer. It is I. Do not be afraid." And Peter answered him and said, "Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water." So he said, "Come." And when Peter had come down out of the boat, he walked on the water to go to Jesus. Now, some people knock Peter as being this coward because he denied Jesus in the presence of the little servant girl and everything. But this is some serious boldness, is it not? "Lord, if that's really you, then command me to come to you right on the water." And he did that. He walked across the water. He was able to do that which is impossible. But because Jesus commanded it, he was able to do the impossible. And that's something, again, to remember. We can see impossibilities in our lives. But if Jesus is in it, it becomes a possibility, doesn't it? Don't doubt. He is able to do that which we would consider to be impossible. But, check this out, verse 30. But when he saw that the wind was boisterous, he was afraid, and beginning to sink, he cried out, saying, "Lord, save me." And immediately Jesus stretched out his hand and caught him and said to him, "Oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt?" And when they got into the boat, the wind ceased. Then those who were in the boat came and worshiped him, saying, "Truly, you are the Son of God." What happened to Peter? He got his eyes off of Jesus, didn't he? When he had his eyes on Jesus, he was able to walk above the storms that this life throws at us. But when we get our eyes on the circumstances, we begin to drown in the midst of them. And those things happen. You know, we're walking with the Lord, we're able to handle the difficult times, but when we start looking at the difficulties, we start becoming consumed by them. What do we do when that happens? We do what Peter did, right? "Lord, save me." And what did Jesus do? Immediately reached down and was able to bring him back up so that he could walk above the difficulty. When the children of Israel came out of Egypt, they were commanded not to fight against the Ammonites, the Moabites, and the Edomites. And that was because they were distant relatives. And so they were out there and they had to totally steer clear of them on their way into the Promised Land. But in the days of King Jehoshaphat, the Ammonites, the Moabites, and the Edomites gathered together and came to attack him. And King Jehoshaphat had a great multitude coming against him, which was too much for him to handle. And notice what he did, 2 Chronicles chapter 20, verse 12. He cried out, "O our God, will you not judge them? For we have no power against this great multitude that is coming against us, nor do we know what to do, but our eyes are upon you." You ever feel like that? I don't know what to do, Lord, but I'm looking to you. And that is the key, to keep our eyes on Jesus. When we keep our eyes on him, again, we can walk above the storms of life. But when we get them on our circumstances, we're just going to drown in the midst of that. And again, what do? When that part happens is we cry out, "Lord, save me." And immediately Jesus will be there. He'll be there to give us the comfort and the peace that we need. Jesus is only a prayer away. I said, "Why did you doubt?" He's there to help us in our time of need. He will never leave you. I want to leave you with Isaiah chapter 43, verses 2 and 3, where it says, "When you pass through the waters, I will be with you. And through the rivers, they shall not overflow you. When you walk through the fire, you shall not be burned, nor shall the flame scorch you. For I am the Lord your God, the Holy One of Israel, your Savior." The promises that God gave to his people then are the promises that we can hold on to today, because he's the same yesterday, today, and forever. And as I look at this and I think about the waters and the rivers and the fire, I mean, just think about what God did for his people. When Moses brought the children of Israel out of Egypt, he took them through the midst of the Red Sea. And he took them all the way through with the Egyptian army in hot pursuit behind them. And what did God do? He was with them and took them all the way through and then brought the Red Sea down upon the Egyptian army. When Joshua was coming to bring Israel into the Promised Land, it tells us that the Jordan River was at flood stage at that time. But what did God do? He stopped the Jordan River and the children of Israel came through on dry ground, and then it returned to flood stage. So through the waters, through the rivers, through the fire, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. How about that? They would not bow down. So they were thrown into the fiery furnace. And King Nebuchadnezzar, he looked in and he said, "Did we not throw three in there? But I see four walking around unharmed, and the fourth has the form of the Son of God." And they came out. And it says that their clothes were not burned, their hair was not singed, they didn't even smell like smoke. It seems like the only thing that had been burned away were the ropes that bound them, because God is with them. And again, you guys, he is the same. Keep your eyes on him.